Right now on the Daily Debrief, R. Kelly faces new child sex charges, this time in Minnesota.
There was dancing and sexual contact.
His attorney, Steve Greenberg, joined the debrief exclusively. And testimony begins in a brutal kidnapping, rape, and murder case of a Tennessee college couple.
You just wouldn't have thought that it would have been him.
The defense claims the suspect was nowhere near the scene of the crime. Plus, closing arguments in the Hollywood Ripper serial killer trial and sentencing for the so-called MAGA bomber, convicted of sending homemade bombs to opponents of the president. The Daily Debrief recaps the day's most interesting legal stories. It's Tuesday, August 6th. Hi, everyone. I'm Dan Abrams. R&B singer R. Kelly, already in federal custody, is now facing two new criminal charges. Tonight, his attorney Steve Greenberg speaking exclusively to Law and Crime. Prosecutors in Minnesota are charging R. Kelly with engaging in prostitution with a minor. This means the singer is now facing a total of four sets of separate sex crime charges. R. Kelly remains behind bars in New York on accusations he sexually abused women and girls. The singer pleaded not guilty to charges in New York and Illinois and maintains his innocence. The latest allegation dates back to 2001, when Kelly allegedly met an underage fan at a Minneapolis concert. According to the criminal complaint, the victim says R. Kelly brought her to his hotel room, paid her $200 to dance, and engaged in sexual acts with her. Hennepin County Attorney Michael Freeman spoke about charging Kelly, even though he already faces numerous other, arguably more serious charges.
This kind of conduct, particularly juveniles, is simply not acceptable in the state of Minnesota or, frankly, anywhere. She was a juvenile at the time. We have special laws to protect our juveniles, and we are going to enforce them. Some might say, aren't you piling on? He's got federal charges in New York. He's got state charges in Cook County and elsewhere. Well, frankly, Minnesota victims deserve their day in court, and that's one of the reasons we're here.
Freeman went on to explain why the typical three-year statute of limitations would not apply here. I'm joined now by R. Kelly's attorney, Steve Greenberg. Thanks very much for taking the time. Appreciate it.
So, how are you, Dan?
Good, good. You tweeted out the complaint, which I read. So, and you mentioned that it was an abuse of prosecutorial discretion. How so?
Well, so from what I understand, there's a 17-year-old girl who never told R. Kelly that she was 17. Came to his room, this is according to the allegations of the complaint, I haven't spoken to him about it yet, came to his room, got naked, danced for him, climbed on top of him, they never had sex, and she didn't complain about it ever. It would have been perfectly lawful under Minnesota law for them to have sex because she was 17. So the prosecutor goes out and says, well, I'm gonna find some other statute that has an 18-year threshold and comes up with this ridiculous prostitution charge. Nowhere in his own criminal complaint does it say that she was paid for sex or to agree to have sex, which is the essence of a prostitution charge.
The allegations do include sexual conduct, though, right? I mean, the claim is that, you know, they're sort of rubbing up naked, he paid her money to do it, et cetera, which is, I guess, the heart of the argument.
Well, no, it doesn't say that he paid her money to rub against him naked. It says that he paid her money to dance. Then it says she stripped and she started rubbing against him. Doesn't say he started doing anything.
Do you worry that just the number of allegations more broadly makes it harder and harder for him to say everybody's lying?
Well, it's not a question of everybody lying. It's a question of how we interpret things in some of the cases. In some of the cases, it's people lying. There's actually seven cases now. There's four in Cook County. There's the two federal. There's the Minnesota one. Obviously, the law of averages is going to catch up with us at some point. But, you know, it's this sort of buyer's remorse. In many of these cases, with many of these allegations, these were people that were ecstatic to be with R. Kelly. They were happy to be with R. Kelly. And now someone else has said to them, oh, no, it was no good. Times have changed. And in hindsight, they're sort of repurposing the encounters.
But in many of these cases, you're talking about girls, not women. And when you talk about buyer's remorse, a girl can't consent legally.
Well, that's not true. In many of these cases, you're talking about women. There are the cases where they claim that he videotaped underage women. There are a couple of women who claim that he had sex with them while they were underage, one here in Cook County. She admits that she told him she was 19. She went to his trial every day. You had to be 18. You had to show identification to get into the trial. He would see her at the trial. So all of the facts show that she at least represented herself to be of age.
But you know that statutory rape, you don't have to necessarily, I mean, if someone lies, the person, even if the person did lie, is still responsible as a legal matter, right?
That's not true in Illinois. It's not true in Illinois. In Illinois, if someone lies about their age, and you should have known. So if a 10-year-old says that they're 18,
right,
then maybe there's a question. But no, it is a defense in Illinois if someone has misrepresented their age.
It can be a defense, right? But the bottom line is that, you know, it is still, when you're talking about the crime of, you know, statutory rape or however it's specifically defined, the bottom line is when someone's underage, they're underage.
Well, they're underage, but it's not what we like to refer to as a strict liability offense. You still have to know they're underage. So in Illinois, the age of consent is 17. If someone is 16 years, 11 months, and they tell you they're 17 years old, you shouldn't be responsible because they lied about it. That doesn't criminalize the conduct.
Is it fair to say that up to this point, R. Kelly got sort of lucky? Meaning, I think your position is he got really unlucky, right? That this new Lifetime documentary came out, and suddenly your position is all these women come out of the woodwork. And yet, if you go back and you look at his previous trial, and you even look in 2003, when they found an enormous amount of incriminating evidence that was all thrown out based on an illegal search, you could say, wow, he got really lucky back then on a legal technicality, and now it's sort of all coming back to bite him.
Well, what I would say is that he won that case. Jury heard the evidence in the case. He won a motion to suppress. Like anyone else who won a motion to suppress, he's entitled to have his constitutional
rights. That's a legal defense. True. Yep.
Right. It's not luck. It's a legal defense. And that after that point, when you look at his conduct from that point going forward, he has absolutely not committed any violations of the law. He hasn't been with any underage women unless they blatantly lied to him and showed him fake identification. He's taken every step to make sure that he did not find himself in the same position again. And if you look at these cases, they're hashing up these old allegations in the federal cases. They're going back under the separate sovereign doctrine, and they're rehashing old allegations. Now, I would say that's unfair, and that is unlucky. So I would say he's not lucky. I would say he's unlucky and unfair.
Have there been any discussions in any of the cases about a possible plea agreement?
No. I'm not saying that there never will be, but there have not been.
All right. Steve Greenberg, thank you very much for coming on the show. We really appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks, Dan.
So what is next for R. Kelly? How can a man facing so many charges in several states across the U.S. Continue to defend himself and be prosecuted, et cetera? Joining me now to break all this down is criminal defense attorney and former prosecutor Mike Korbanix, trial attorney Bob Hilla, and Judge Ashley Wilcott. All right, so let's talk about, first of all, what we just heard, Judge Wilcott. Is he right about the law in Illinois that basically it is a defense to say, I didn't know that the person was underage?
Well, I think it can be claimed as a defense, but it doesn't mean that the actual statute hasn't been violated. So I agree with what you said, Dan, which is it's still a crime, regardless of the age. And then if he does prove that, it might be accepted as a defense under the Illinois law. It's very different in other states.
And Bob, what about this sort of magnitude? What about the fact that you've got all these different cases in different jurisdictions? How are they going to balance all of those from a prosecutorial perspective?
Well, that's going to be an interesting question as to which court gets him first. The federal courts may try and take charge of this, as they often do, and the state courts will have to play catch up.
And Mike, this Minnesota case does seem like comparatively the least significant, and I say least significant not in an effort to minimize it, but just to talk about in sort of ranking where the cases may start. This Minnesota one is probably going to go to the bottom, no?
I would think so. I think they're going to lead off with the best case they have, because there's only so much time a person can do. I mean, he gets a couple convictions. I mean, his lawyer said eventually, I think he said words to the effect, the odds will be against us. And I think that's sort of what the Minnesota case will do, because there'll be a point in time when, although every victim has a right to be heard, it's really not going to be judicially economical to try him on so many different cases.
All right, I'm going to ask you all to stand by, because we've got other cases that we are covering this evening. Closing arguments are happening right now in Los Angeles in the trial of the alleged Hollywood Ripper serial killer. Michael Garagiulo is facing two murder charges in the stabbing deaths of Ashley Ellerin and Maria Bruno, and one attempted murder charge for allegedly stabbing Michelle Murphy. All of these occurred between 2001 and 2008. He's also accused of killing an 18-year-old woman outside of Chicago. He'll stand trial in Illinois after the California case concludes. Now, video cameras have only been allowed in court during opening statements and closing arguments. So right now, we can bring you a portion of the prosecution's closing argument.
11 years ago, a 26-year-old woman had the strength and courage to fight off a killer. Thanks to her toughness, not only was she able to survive, but she forced her left-handed attacker to cut his right wrist, leaving him bleeding on her bed and leaving a blood trail that took investigators not only back to his apartment, but took investigators to answers that they had been seeking for 15 years. That blood trail led to the killer of Tricia Picaccio, the killer of Ashley Ellerin, and the killer of Maria Bruno.
The defense's strategy to try to poke holes in each of the women's case one by one. Here's how they tried to introduce reasonable doubt about whether Garagiulo killed the victim that was supposed to have a date with actor Ashton Kutcher. Coming up on the Daily Debrief, the man convicted of mailing bombs to the critics of the president, sentenced by the judge. Hear what he told the judge. Plus, a young couple tortured and murdered. One of the men, prosecutors say, is responsible, now on trial. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Daily Debrief. A federal judge sentenced the man known as the MAGA bomber to 20 years in prison. Cesar Sayoc pleaded guilty in March to sending 16 bombs in the mail to critics of President Trump. His targets included former President Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, actor Robert De Niro, and CNN. Sayoc apologized at his sentencing, saying he was a sick man. None of the bombs exploded. A jury is seated in the trial of a Tennessee man accused of double murder in the death of a college couple. Eric Boyd faces life in prison if convicted in the deaths of 21-year-old Shannon Christian and 23-year-old Christopher Newsom. The details of their deaths are gruesome. Both victims were allegedly beaten, raped, and murdered. Newsom was shot three times, then doused in gasoline and set on fire. Christian is believed to have been held captive for 24 hours, repeatedly sexually assaulted, and then stuffed in a trash can and left to die, slowly suffocating. Boyd claims he wasn't anywhere near the home when the crime occurred. Four other co-defendants have already been convicted in the case. LaMarcius Davidson, the alleged ringleader, was sentenced to death for first-degree murder. Latavius Cobbins and George Thomas received life sentences for first-degree murder. And now Thomas will testify against Boyd. In exchange, he will likely see his sentence reduced to 50 years. Vanessa Coleman was acquitted of first-degree murder, but found guilty of lesser crimes and received 35 years. In opening statements, prosecutors gave a graphic description of how the victims had been raped and tortured and the condition their bodies were found in.
She was nude from the waist down, no underwear, no pants, no shoes. She was tied in a manner, hogtied, is the best way I can describe it. Her legs were pulled up so that her vaginal and anus are exposed. At the autopsy, Chris is identified as being the body on the train tracks. His legs have been bound with a piece of floral fabric and his belt. His socks have been stuffed in his mouth. There was a gag that was timed. Gag in his mouth. His arms had been tied behind him, his hands. There's a bandana over his eyes. There's a sweatshirt wrapped around his head. Mr. Newsom had been shot in the shoulder, in the lower back, and was shot in his head. Before that, he had been raped angrily. After being shot, he'd been covered with some type of fabric. An accelerant had been poured on the fabric, and he'd been set on fire.
The defense countered with the lack of DNA evidence connecting Boyd to the crimes and attacked the prosecution's use of co-defendant as a witness against Boyd.
You know whose DNA wasn't there? At any of the scenes? Eric Boyd. There's no DNA evidence that shows that he was involved in the abduction, that he was involved in the rapes, or that he was involved in the murder. Basically, what they've done is they've reprinted the indictments that they used to convict the murderers of Shannon and Chris, and they got an indictment against Mr. Boyd. Again, what was it that brought about this turn of events? You know, it's a lot of speculation. Was it new evidence? Well, look here, there was additional testing.
The states tested just about everything from every crime scene that they could possibly. There's nothing really incriminating against Mr. Boyd.
What you've got is they want to take the testimony of a twice convicted murderer whose word wasn't good enough for the state 11 years ago. And they made a devil's bargain with him. 50 years at 85%
versus two consecutive life terms.
Christopher Newsom's best friend spoke about getting the news that his missing friend's body had been found.
We hear of a body found by the railroad tracks. But at that point, didn't know. Wouldn't have thought it would have been Newsom at that point.
Why not?
just, you just wouldn't have thought that it would have been him, you know. We ended up going back to Washington Ridge Apartments, a CARES apartment, and meet the detectives over there, and they were questioning everyone. We were trying to figure out, you know, what was going on. And I believe it was a little after one, whenever Newsom's brother called, and Dennis, he called and said that the dental records come back, and it was Newsom by the railroad tracks.
Tough stuff to listen to. Next, a witness described seeing the victim's allegedly stolen car outside of one of Boyd's co-defendant's home.
As I'm sitting there, the 4Runner with the lights on then drives off, and they drive in my direction, which, you know, it's nothing odd about that. But they drove in my direction, and as they got right there in the bend, they slowed down, kind of, you know, checked me out and whatnot, see if I could see them or see, you know, who I was, I guess. They then went all the way around to the front of the building. And at that time, I'm already kind of on alert because they slowed down to look at me. I couldn't see any faces, so I couldn't tell you who was in the vehicle, but I could definitely tell how many. It was 4 people in the vehicle. The driver, to me, seemed to be the tallest. He had on a bomber coat with a fur collar, if you will, almost like your bubble jacket, I guess, kind of deal. Because you could see in that silhouette, I could see the fur around the collar. And the passenger, the far back passenger on the right side, he was slumped down in the seat like he was trying to hide.
So how many people total did you see in the movie?
Total 4.
Did you tell what sex they were?
To me, they were all men, and from their demeanor, I thought they were black men. Just because of the behavior, the way they were driving.
All right, so Bob, is this car the most incriminating piece of evidence against Boyd, do you think?
Well, at this point, it's the only link between Boyd and the crime.
Judge Wilcott, but they have more than just, right, the car. I mean, they have other witnesses as well who link him to the scene.
Absolutely. And so while they don't have his DNA at the scene at all, Dan, they do definitely have circumstantial evidence that putting it together is a puzzle of everyone identifying what car he was in. It belonged to his cousin. It was there to put him at the scene.
But how important, Mike, is the witness who is convicted of murder now, who, as the defense attorney pointed out, 11 years ago, you didn't believe anything he said, and now he's your star witness about what happened?
You know, Dan, you make a great point, and that's a problem. And I think it's a problem in his case because it's really just his word. There's nothing to corroborate what he's going to say because there is no DNA. And I really don't know if he made such a great deal. I mean, he went from 2 life terms to 50 years. At his age, that's 50 with 85. That's pretty near a life sentence.
Yeah, but when he's questioned, he will definitely be cross-examined in a very aggressive way. Is the case against Boyd simply weaker than the cases against these other defendants?
I think so, because there is no DNA evidence, and that's the way that it's weaker.
And you have no DNA first, then you have additional testing, no link, and the only attack really is this witness who didn't pass a credibility test the first time.
All right, thank you all for joining us tonight. Appreciate it. Our live trial coverage resumes at 9 o'clock in the morning. Thanks for watching.